Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, by popular demand, we're going to talk about someone who founded a group that today remains extremely important to nationalists of all stripes. One of the most controversial movements and ideas, and that of national Bolshevism, Ustrilov, Nikolai Ustrilov, who was shot by the secret police in 1937. He's controversial because he attempted really to do something that many thought was impossible, that is, trying to rationalize the Soviet Empire, attempting to give a right-wing spin, so to speak, of the Soviet takeover. He's written a tremendous amount of material. As far as I know, none of it is in English. It's certainly worth reading. There are some out there who say that Ustrilov's mentality was just as someone who saw Bolshevism as a fait accompli, so he made his peace with it. And there are others who say that the Patriarch Sergius, not Moscow Patriarchate, was a follower of his and saw Bolshevism as a right-wing movement, not as a leftist movement. In fact, Ustrilov defines those terms, and those terms are used a lot. I use them only for the sake of, because they're so common. But it's very clear what we mean. And the movement itself, National Bolshevism, makes this very clear too, and I think it's worthwhile. And they refer to a right-wing group. They're referring to an idea that stresses the historic community, the nation, the race, the ethnic group, the religion, a tradition, historical continuity. This is the foundation for politics, morals, economics, whatever. The left is any idea that rejects that and seeks something else, something usually invented, as the foundation, something vague like reason, as if reason can legislate for itself. Or even a class, which in the Soviet Union, that definition ended up going completely off the rails by the late 1920s. So you had a situation where Trotsky was saying that an impoverished priest in Ukraine was a member of the ruling class, but Jacob Schiff was a proletarian. Where a kulak was somebody who opposed the Soviet regime, no matter how poor they might be. Actually, I think that's a worthwhile way to define left and right. Traditionally, those terms come from the Roman Empire. The right is your sword hand, your left is your dagger hand. The one is, I know I've mentioned this on the show before, is the right is truth and fair dealing. The left is deviousness, the shadow, so to speak. Ustrilov's primary concept was the state. The state rules everything. And this, to this extent, he was very, very close to Mussolini. The state is based on power, power as coercion. Now, generally speaking, coercion doesn't have to be just threats of violence. Coercion is, for the most part, mental. You have to convince people that you have the right to exercise power. Whether it's true or not, you have to manipulate them. Even legitimate governments have enemies. And so power is the ability to mobilize mental resources, for lack of a better phrase. The concept of rulership and subordination he finds in everything, in all human relations, in the natural order. There's nothing wrong with this if based on a moral idea. He does, though, he does call the state the community of voluntary obedience. Now, I'm reading all of his material in the original, so I certainly hope my translations are okay. I am self-taught, so, but I believe I'm right translating it that way. It's voluntary obedience. In other words, mental power, the idea that these people will voluntarily say, you have a right to be in power, you have a right to rule us, that this is what's being mobilized by the state. The primary concept of all national Bolshevists simply states that Bolshevism is not communism. Communism being Marxism. Ostroilov rejected materialism and naturalism, generally speaking, but he refused to say that the doctrines of Karl Marx ruled the Soviet Union. And he's probably right to say that, in my opinion. Karl Marx was not taken seriously throughout the entire existence of the USSR, although lip service was played to it. And Karl Marx played the same function in the Soviet Union as the U.S. Constitution plays today. It's a cheap prop and nothing more. It's not taken seriously by those in power. It's referenced all the time, but manipulated as anyone sees fit. In Soviet history, a ruler, a dictator, had to couch his terms. Even the opposition had to couch its terms in Marxist language. And after a while, that meant that you had to really stretch these definitions of the terms, and that you could make Marx pretty much say whatever you want. This is the problem with the written word, that you can make a good case for pretty much any point of view, especially if you have the power to do so. The state is based on discipline. The truth of the matter is that the Western world is based on a few things. Mechanism. When I say Western world, by the way, I mean post-Enlightenment. Mechanism, individualism, popular sovereignty, liberalism in general, in a very, very, very broad sense. Yet most people are incapable of using freedom of thought. All the other freedoms are founded on freedom of thought, because you can't do anything without first thinking about it. And this also produces responsibility. It's your fault if something goes wrong when you act. Most people hate freedom. Most people hate the idea that in an age of tremendous moral confusion, they're held responsible for the acts that they commit, including the consequences that they didn't intend. Most people are far more content in being a part of the mass. This is Das Mann in Heidegger, bad faith in Sartre. This is the idea that being a part of the anonymous crowd is so much easier. Going along for the sake of getting along is what most people do. It isn't even so much that they're blaming others. They're not taking any responsibility at all. Mental power is at the center of everything. Like all of these kind of movements, though, history is made by determined minorities. Individualism is a complete fraud. I've made that a cornerstone of my own thinking and in this show, the idea that an individual is somehow a moral agent, where even the analysis of individualism requires a community. The English language, all the arguments, all the books you read, all the people who went into publishing the books, all of this. So even arguing individualism is a refutation of it. But apart from that, it's frightening This is the beginning of the existential movement, where freedom is seen as this deadly curse, as power should be seen. Reason is not the foundation of most people's actions or loyalties. Most people don't really think deeply about anything. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. Not everyone can be a scholar. Everyone, however, should know his place and his particular role in the society, whatever function they perform. That they should think deeply about. But in terms of the social world, most people simply go along. Living in the Soviet Union was just as natural as us living, 100 years ago. It's so much easier to be a part of the anonymous crowd and hence not have to take any responsibility. It's the irrational, the biological, the will to power, the subconscious, that matters far more to the average person, especially in the postmodern age. To claim that reason is the foundation of all human acts, or it should be, or that neoliberalism and democracy, the free market, they all do claim this. That reason and freedom of thought is the foundation of all acts is now ridiculous. Psychology has destroyed this. It rests on a very untenable libertarian concept of human agency. It ignores the subconscious. It ignores the mass. It ignores the biological drives, the irrational drives. Most people operate from the subconscious, for better or for worse. He defines the state as the highest form of human communication. That's an extremely important way to put it, because it puts language, as I've said many times before, at the center of everything. The nation, which is not something that Ustrelov stresses. The nation is founded on language. And we mean that in the very, very broad sense. We're not just talking about words and grammar. We're talking about everything that governs our interaction with others. Most people don't think very deeply about that either. Most of our communication is nonverbal. We assume many things about people who we interact with every day. And we're taken aback when they don't follow those assumptions. You can't rationalize. You can't go into deep analysis of every action you make. That's simply impossible. So without routine, you couldn't function. Communication, and hence language, is the primary element. The state is different from the nation. He's making that very, very clear. He makes it clear in his criticism of the Slavophiles. The nation is too vague for him. He doesn't like the concept of vague, wispy, theoretical entities. He wants hard and fast, very crisp notions that he can use in public policy. He thinks it's the highest form because it is focused power. It is a singular focused power that tolerates no other power, at least in terms of political violence, political authority. And its only justification, there's a tremendous amount of power in one place, its only justification is the common good. Its purpose is to mobilize all the resources under its control. And this is why Ustrelov makes the very controversial claim, as Mussolini did, that the nation is a creation of the state and therefore nations are a modern creation. I personally reject that notion. It's true that the state can and has given far greater exactitude to the nation, but for the most part, the state has been at war with nations. They're not opposites by any means, but they're often in conflict. And they're not the creation of modernity. That's very easy to prove. But again, in his mentality, if it's not a very easy to understand set of concepts with very well-defined boundaries, he wants nothing to do with it. The common interest, the mobilization of all the resources of a population, mental and physical, is what makes the state different than previous forms of communication, previous forms of social life. Now, moderns use the word state normally to refer to the institutions of government, courts, police, bureaucracies, whatever. Now, that's where it gets foggy, because Hegel, I did my master thesis on Hegel's philosophy of right in St. Louis. The state is not that. The state is what we would call the nation state. That the state is unthinkable outside of the nation, and therefore it partakes of it. There is no distinction. The state is the common culture manifest in government. Well, it may have made sense in Prussia at the time, but in a decadent place like America, it no longer makes any sense. Americans aren't used to these concepts because there is no American ethnicity. There is no American nation. It's called the United States. It's a federation. The first form of government we had were the Articles of Confederation. They weren't kidding about that. It's a group of nations. So the European national forms still exist in America. Now, major media, especially since the Civil War, have tried to downplay ethnic boundaries in American life, and instead focused on race, because it's easy to, it's easier to sell papers. It's easy to an uneducated population to simply talk about black, white, Asian, Hispanic. Slaves, of course, not knowing where they're from in Africa, only had the color of their skin, and of course the culture that came from their condition. Whites, however, were different, because most of us know what part of Europe we come from. But that's been de-emphasized, and we've all been thrown into this white category. Even though in Europe, there are different civilizations. I don't believe in a single European civilization. Certainly, at least since the first millennium, the distinction between the Byzantine, Russian, and the Germano-Roman, they are very, very different. It doesn't mean that they're opposites. It doesn't mean they have to be always at war, but they are very different. It is not one civilization. Now, the idea of the common culture, though, is essential. You can write a law on a piece of paper. You can have it passed by a legislature, have it signed by a president. But if it doesn't coincide with the way that people are accustomed to behave, you have to have a massive police force to be able to enforce it. Over time, what happens is that compromises are made. If you create this alien concept, let's say that you force people to do 25 miles an hour on the highway for no good reason, it's going to be very, very hard to enforce. Most people are going to ignore it. What will probably happen is that most people will start doing maybe 50. Anything over that will be result in a ticket. There's always these kind of compromises when something bizarre like that is done, something alien, something that's an imposition on a population. You can't enforce it entirely. He says that about the takeover of the Soviet Union, though. Something so radically alien at first then made its peace with what is Russia. The National Bolshevik movement has a bit of a gap in their mentality, in that the initial revolutionary movement was an alien force. What it created, though, in terms of the Bolshevik government, Soviet government, couldn't be an alien force for long. It became Russian because this was in Russia and Ukraine. And in fact, the Soviet Union became a concrete entity because it mobilized not just Russia and Ukraine, but all of Central Asia and the Far East. It developed its own specific identity that way. You can argue that there's an American ethnicity on the same grounds, that we are very different, but we do hold certain things in common. And so you end up with the propositional idea that Sam Francis always condemned. Propositions come from nations, though. Propositions don't come from randomly. the gap between fact and law is often a monstrous one. There's always going to be compromises. When the Soviet Union was founded, the initial explosion of utopian communism didn't last for very long. And Ustrelov took the new economic policy as an admission of defeat, that they simply couldn't maintain this utopian project. Once he got that out of its system, it now had to compromise with the Russian people and the Russian mentality. And this is really how this group came to vaguely justify the Soviet Union. In fact, Ustrelov himself was working in the USSR, trying to find a place in the USSR. He was in exile in China for a while. And he struggled for recognition. The Soviet government generally did not take his views sympathetically. And he was shot. I guess the actual charge was spying for the Japanese in 1937. Being from the, you know, living in the Far East for so long. But it was generally anti-Soviet activity. And the National Bolshevik movement had nothing to do with the Soviet Union from there on in, under Stalin. I've argued consistently that Stalin was not a nationalist, was not a national Bolshevik at all. The very fact that they murdered Ustrelov is some evidence for that. What you see when you read his works is this constant attempt to reinterpret the language of the Bolshevik government in ways congenial to right-wing thinking. And sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes it's simply too much. For example, he claims to be an internationalist, as Stalin did. But internationalism was, in his definition, a way that Russia can exert its authority in international affairs, that it was a major power. Not that it was somehow a part of this global mass movement, but because, but as a strong unified power that was feared, it had a tremendous role in foreign affairs and international affairs in general. That's what internationalism meant for him. That's not what it meant to Marx or Lenin or Trotsky or Stalin. But that's essential. And it's one of the ways that you see these guys just taking all of these concepts and desperately trying. You know, once it was clear, he was part of the White Army at one time. And once it was lost, you know, what choices did he have? He could go underground, like the Catacomb Church did. He could go into exile, which he did for a short time. Or he could try to make peace with it. And it's so much easier to make peace with it. And so he really had to... he really had to stretch the definition of things. In other words, the state in this particular case is not just a set of laws. It can never be just a set of laws. There has to be a connection between the civilization and the legal order. When someone obeys a law, they're not obeying it because they've gone through this scholarly analysis as to why it's justified. The state is able to coerce you in this way, in this manner, but it's because of a certain loyalty, friendship with other citizens. It's not it's an immediate reaction, not an immediate reaction. States, no matter how rationalized they try to be, no matter how legal they try to be, they're still run by people. And people they remain free. And they can make decisions, they can make compromises. A policeman has tremendous leeway in whether to give a ticket. In certain circumstances, even when to arrest or not to arrest. A judge has tremendous leeway in sentencing, for example. A prosecutor has a lot of leeway as to what charges will be filed and what won't be. There's always a human element. It doesn't matter how strictly legal an order is, the human element is never gone. So if there's that human element, which could never leave, there is therefore the national, civilizational, and cultural element. And this is why the gap between law and fact, the fact the reality of the nation, the ethnic group, it could never be ignored. And this is why the Soviet Union could never be a consistently revolutionary group. It had to make its peace with old Russia in order to function at all. And it was able to function in his mind because it did make peace with certain aspects of the Russian past. Now, again, I personally disagree with that notion. It was always an alien element propped up by the West. And I've been through this many, many times in the past. But you can understand why someone would say that, you know, Patriarch Sergius of the MP would say, you know, this isn't really a leftist materialist group. They may mouth those words, but in reality, it's still Russia underneath. The ideological, legal side of things does not totally overwhelm the Russian side of things. Behind all law, therefore, any statute, there lies a certain degree of blind coercion because of the human element. Because people, individuals, have to enforce it. Policemen are actual people. They're not machines. Oddly enough, he makes reference to a deep state in the Soviet Union. He calls it a hidden state, is the way I translated it. That seems to be a common phrase these days. It's taken from my term regime, which refers to the present global ruling class of the network of government power, academic power, journalistic power, capitalist power, financial power, etc., operating informally together through meetings like the Bilderbergs and everything else. That's what rules society. And so who you elect for Congress is completely irrelevant. The deep state is something vaguely like that. The fact that they use the word state suggests that they're all part of the legal order. That's not true. At least in America, now this was not a problem in the Soviet Union, but in America, capitalism rules everything. The government is completely dependent on banks and the major industrial firms. One of the things that Ustryloff said was a great victory for the NEP was that it made open contacts and trading with the Western world. Now, this is odd. Most of us were taught in school that the West was vehemently opposed to Marxism, communism from the minute it took over in 1921. And yet consistently, through any book you could read on the history of the Soviet Union, there is tremendous and ongoing trade with the West. Trade, aid, loans, exchanges of all kinds. The truth of the matter is, of course, that the West supported the Soviet Union from day one, even at the very end of World War I, because it was the strongest alternative. It had this, you know, the West wasn't anti-communist because the West didn't know what communism was. Very few people had read Marx in any detail. The West, and I mean the ruling class of the West, London, Washington, D.C., they sure as hell didn't know what Bolshevism was. They saw it as simply Russian nationalism in some very, very vague, very vague way. So they weren't opposed to it, and they didn't fight it. Now, an actual Russian nationalist or social nationalist state like you have today under Putin, the U.S. is pretty much at war with. At no time in the Cold War, so-called, was the U.S. ever this close to war, not even in the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's a massive buildup of American forces surrounding the USSR for reasons that no one can quite figure out. And this utter nonsense of the Russians, in some vague sense, controlling an election. This is nothing more than the left licking its wounds after being humiliated in the election, where every major media, every major academic expert, with a handful of exceptions, a tiny handful of exceptions, said that it's absolutely certain that Hillary Clinton is going to win. It's just wishful thinking, and they have egg all over their face. These, by the way, are often the same people that didn't recognize the Soviet Union was collapsing. In 1990, the CIA said that the Soviet Union was doing well. But they're in the process of transformation from a command economy to somewhat of a command slash market economy. They didn't even see that the whole system was collapsing. The Soviet Union had deep ties with the West, and in fact it was so bad that Stalin even began to worry about Russia's national sovereignty, because American capitalists built every aspect of the Soviet Union, heavy industry. The Rockefellers built the oil industry. GE built the electric grid. There were several mining companies from Alaska that were mining the coal and the gold. Major steel. Carnegie's were involved in building the steel industry, and Henry Ford building the Soviet automotive industry. Remember, in 1936, Henry Ford created the largest Ford plant in the world in eastern Ukraine. And from that comes the entire Soviet automotive industry. What kind of a war is this? Well, there couldn't have been a Cold War if that's the case. And this was a consistent posture of the West towards the USSR. Only now, where there's an actual nationalist government that is planning on dumping the U.S. dollar as the means as a currency for oil sales, all of a sudden there's a massive military buildup against it. The vicious, inhuman attacks on Putin and the American press, this was never to be found any Soviet dictator. None of them. They were treated like any other world leader. The Cold War is a myth in that sense. They certainly had different interests internationally. That's the case with any two powers, even two allied powers. That's not enough to call it a war. So as Americans are fighting the Viet Cong, American capitalists are supplying the Soviet Union with the goods that they're in turn sending to the North Vietnamese government. The U.S. was so deep, when I say U.S., I mean U.S. capital, was so deeply invested in the Soviet Union that to claim that there was any war between the East and the West is utter nonsense. Furthermore, there's only one aspect of Russian culture, and that's Russian Orthodox culture. Religion is the foundation of everything Russian. There was no real literacy in Russia prior to St. Vladimir's conversion, because it brought in the Greek and then later the Cyrillic script. For the first time, mass production of books was created. And the culture is a religious one. It may find its roots in natural law and the ancient ways, but it's expressed itself in religious terms. So to claim that there's a Russian culture outside of the, generally speaking, outside of its moral and religious foundation is absurd. So there was never any compromise, as Ustilov would claim, between the Bolsheviks and Russia as a cultural entity. The Bolsheviki were at war consistently with all things Russian, all things Ukrainian. Some of the smaller states were able to buy their independence, like Georgia and Armenia were able to, because they filled their quotas, sometimes they filled them early, they were able to be left alone for a while. That's why sometimes, not always, but sometimes the persecution was less there. But the great Russians and Ukrainians and Belarusians, the true culture, the old culture, was something viciously attacked by both East and West. But what he means by the hidden state, the deep state, in this particular case, is that when a government takes over with a certain revolutionary idea, making that revolutionary lifestyle permanent is impossible. This was actually the subject of my doctoral dissertation, Michael Oakeshott, and the distinction between language and political reality. Ideology is just in words and in thoughts, but that's not how people act. What fills that gap, for the most part, is violence. And that was Michael Oakeshott's big concern in rationalism and politics and everything else. And that became the subject of my doctoral dissertation. And there was a certain continuity because, you know, Oakeshott was a Hegelian of sorts. And I always remained a Hegelian, always very, very interested in him. Oakeshott was a much later British idealist that took most of its ammunition from Hegel. So this hidden state or this deep state is the national or the civilizational core that can never go away. It's a soul. It's immaterial, of course. Only a materialist can think that law is just a mechanism. Law can just be put in place and then everything runs like a machine. No, not when you're dealing with human beings. There are always gaps in the law. There's always leeway. History is made, as I said before, I mentioned by fanatical minorities, but also fanatical minorities motivated by what he calls passionate ideas. But these can't necessarily be the core of state action, at least not for long. Compromises will have to be made. There's this claim that if America became a socialist state, it would have to make compromises with the so-called American democratic tradition, and so it wouldn't be as totalitarian as the Soviet Union. A, that claimed the Soviet Union didn't have a democratic foundation in the past, which is wrong. And B, that there's a democratic tradition in America that's anything other than oligarchy, which is also wrong. So it's a stupid point of view. And it was very popular in academic circles. But the concept is identical, that you impose an ideology on a group of people. I don't care how much violence you use. I don't care how much coercion you use. The traditions of the people will eventually shine through and mold the ideology and channel the ideology eventually over time. You can't have that intense fire of revolution all the time. Trotsky, in his Jewish nationalism and his hatred for all things Russian, claimed the notion of permanent revolution, that this fire has to exist all the time. Any manifestation of Gentile culture had to be smashed with the most extreme violence possible. Another element of his thinking that's very important is youth. He sees his age, and he's writing in the 1920s, of what Gumilev would call passion eras. These very intense young people who had no patience with the old ways, with the old doctrines, and sought to overthrow the old order. He saw this in fascism, in National Socialism, and as well as Bolshevism. That liberal mechanistic thought had collapsed entirely. That these were miserable failures, not just in word, but in deed. He calls democracy dogmatic plutocracy. I'm sorry, demagogic plutocracy. The plutocrats using demagogues to control their to control the masses. The very fact, again, you have the concept of masses, which did not exist in the Middle Ages. Not even it's a modern term. It's the rise of urbanization, industrialism. Can you have masses, these faceless people with no real place or purpose? Demagogues are absolutely necessary to sway them. Again, you have the state in this case a plutocratic one. All democracy has to be that it takes money to buy the media you need to run for office. But that's just it. It's plutocratic in the sense that, I mean, it's and then it's demagogic in that you need to use simplistic, sometimes mindless arguments or just slogans to convince people. And this is where the democratic idea fails. People know their place, their particular role in society, and that's where they function. And that's where they can exercise freedom. That's where they can exercise judgment. That's where they can exercise intellect. But the state is one function among many. It may be the master function in the sense that it organizes all the others, but it's still one function among many. And you can't expect mechanics to follow the ins and outs of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for example, as immensely important as it is. Furthermore, it assumes that politicians have power. It assumes that a politician in taking office is going to be able to transfer that ideology into public policy. There's a tremendous number of assumptions in the democratic idea. There is no foundation for believing that a politician, when elected, will then transfer in some way that ideological content that you think he has into day-to-day policy. That's simply not how it works. I've used this example before, the example of Italy after World War II, where you've had a governments lasting no more than a year, and yet Italy rose to prominence as a first-rate industrial power in the second half of the 20th century. That was proof that politicians don't have power. Politicians are not involved in the day-to-day decision-making of the economic world. No one really even paid attention to the fact that you had this endless array of governments because the bureaucracy remained the same. These are just there as today, unionized career specialists. In the executive branch, which is where bureaucracy is supposed to be, each agency has its own purpose. Every bureaucrat has to have a specialization. So these are far beyond the knowledge of any particular president or executive of any or a government of any kind. So he sees the modern world in the mechanistic plutocratic sense coming to an end. He sees that young people have had enough. And World War One, of course, you know, what more evidence do you need that the scientific revolution and the mechanistic ideas, really the mechanistic social ideas that it gave birth to, which is really his issue, was in a lot of trouble. It was a shock to me how the scientific mentality was able to continue to be on the offensive after World War One, where you had all of the inventions of science put to the concept of warfare, slaughtering more people for no clear reason than all other wars before put together. And that's probably an understatement. Now, in a letter he wrote, he was asked about the distinctions between Eurasianism and National Bolshevism. The two of them have a tendency to be connected, and they are connected. His answer is that National Bolshevism is a fighting creed. It's a very distinctive set of political demands. It's not a political theory in the sense that it's you know a hypothetical ideal state. It's a fighting ideology, where Eurasianism is a far broader, less exact theoretical construct. National Bolshevism is a actual day-to-day policy prescription. And that's the only distinction that he makes between the two. National Bolshevism, in other words, is a way to bring some of the theoretical ideas of Eurasianism to the state and the day-to-day functioning of government and the economy. He does say, though, I mean, he's an internationalist in the sense that he sees global trade. Again, I mentioned it, it's one of the victories of the NEP in his mind, will not destroy nations, even though Karl Marx made it very clear that it will. It simply elevates nations. And this is an assumption that you know, that there's a certain – there's two forms of internationalism. The first form is that globalism will destroy all nations, all borders, and will all essentially be one cultureless people. That, I believe, is kind of the hidden Gnostic mentality of globalism in general. I think most leftists have that as their goal. But there's another form that's tolerable that you find in Ustryla, in the National Bolshevik Movement, and that is interaction on a global scale makes the boundaries among nations clearer. Their interaction doesn't destroy boundaries. It emphasizes them, because nations then take their role in the international arena to strengthen themselves. So at least in that sense, he's a mercantilist in the classical sense. States are concerned with security, and states are concerned with using whatever resources they can from the outside world to use internally. I think it's very naive. And he saw the same thing for the Soviet Union. Now, he did change his opinion, where he did eventually see a great Soviet people, one people coming from the different ethnic groups in the USSR. It may have just been a difference in emphasis. The concept of Soviet patriotism, of course, is a fraud. The idea that there is a Soviet nation is no more tenable than there is an American nation. Both creeds, well, American in the 20th century, claim that they are universal. The Soviets claim they stand for universal revolution. The Americans claim, well, they claim the same thing. They'll put it in different forms. They'll talk about democracy and feminism and access to abortion and stuff like that. But for most of the world, that's exactly what it is. Both groups, remember, capitalism and communism are exactly the same. There's very little distinction between the two. In fact, it takes a lot of work to find out. It's like Islam and Judaism. You know, it's difficult to tell how different they are. They both claim a messianic status. So the notion is the modern world as it stands in the Western world. Again, the Western world claims that modernity is Western liberalism. This is one of Alexander Dugin's big complaints. There is no universalism. There is no internationalism. Internationalism has to have a creed. There has to have, you know, if you're an internationalist, well, what does that mean? You have to have a certain set of policy prescriptions for nations that come under the new global order. Well, what's this state supposed to look like? Well, if you describe it and you lay it out, it has to have an ideological foundation. You might stress procedures. You have to have free elections, and you have to have equal pay for women and easy divorce and stuff like that. But these are still deeply ideological. Procedures are ideological because no one is going to promote a procedure unless they believe the outcome can be favorable to them. Now, today in the news, we see that Poland is being threatened by the European Union, that they have to take in these so-called refugees from the third world by the millions. And they promise all kinds of hellfire if they don't oblige. Now, that proves that this whole refugee thing is a policy attack, is a coordinated attack on nations. It has nothing to do with refugees at all. These are militarized groups. The very fact that they're being forced to do this, which they're refusing as of right now, proves, of course, that they loathe the idea of popular sovereignty. Well, the Poles elected a government that rejects all this. They want to see their government overthrown. So procedures are never about procedures. No one will die for an abstraction. Dugin's concept is that the West tries to claim it's ideological, that is neutral in ideologies, only that procedures remain the same, a marketplace of ideas. But the economy, though, is an oligarchy and always tends to oligarchy. And free trade and liberal democracy and individualism, these are deeply and highly ideological and highly controversial positions. And they're certainly new in the world. There's nothing natural about the market the way Adam Smith laid it out. It was meant to be a revolutionary concept. Terms like the people, I've said for my whole career, you know, in Great Britain at the time of the Civil War, they needed a slogan. The British Parliament needed a slogan that could challenge divine right and natural law, and they came up with the people. It's not meant to actually refer to individuals. It's just an ideological weapon to use. It's extremely vague. And it really doesn't make it, as I was talking about in the Italian case, however the politicians are elected, however they come to power, it could be an aristocracy, it could be a monarchy, whatever it is, you still have to maintain the basic services of any society. All armies are the same. All sanitary functions in civil government are the same. Policing is the same. You know, they follow very, very similar procedures. What difference does it make whether it's monarchist or Soviet or American? The day-to-day functioning of the bureaucracy is exactly the same. Bureaucrats don't change because politicians change. This is the major point of most of the rightist revolutionaries, is that procedures don't mean anything, because in order to run a government, any government, I don't care what the ideology is, you have to have an executive branch that is almost identical. You have to have a diplomatic corps. You have to have an education system. These really don't change very much in terms of its general outline, regardless of where you are. They don't change very much. The way that he put it now, as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, he sees the NEP not so much as the adoption of liberalism, not at all. It just permitted certain farmers to keep some of the profits of their crop. That's really all it was in his mind. There's nothing more than that. The fact that foreign capital was pouring into the Soviet Union, which again is odd if the West was so vehemently opposed to the USSR, it simply meant that it was at a thermidor. It was the Jacobin movement was finished with Lenin, and then by the time of his death, 1920, just a little bit before then, the new economic policy was a slow but sure decay of the utopianism of that era, and Stalin was Napoleon. And so it's dialectical in the true sense of the word. He doesn't like that initial utopian movement. He rejects it. The new economic policy was an admission of the failure of war communism and central planning in a very strict sense. It was internationalist in the sense that it brought the Soviet Union to the world stage and world finance and everything else, but it served as the antithesis. And then Stalinism was the final synthesis of the movement. And this is the Russianization, so to speak, of the revolution. This is the compromise that Bolshevism had to make with all things Russian. Now, again, I have papers on my website that vehemently reject this. It's a common claim. People like Kerry Bolton, who I admire very much, make that claim sort of in a modified sense. But Stalin was no different than Lenin and Trotsky in his ideology, as well as his policy. He just had a far more mature state to work with. He had a far greater bureaucratic apparatus to impose his will. So he sees, even the early utopian era, the first few years of the USSR, he sees it as something positive. The Bolsheviks sought independence of Russians, Ukrainians, etc., against the West. It was a revolt against the bourgeois empires of the U.S. or Great Britain, the Netherlands, France. It was a positive thing in that sense. And again, here you have this tremendous stretch trying to find just whatever he can to justify the fait accompli of the USSR and trying to make it palatable for right-wing people. And I ultimately think he failed. Doesn't mean he's not worthwhile, he's not a great writer, he's not interesting, but ultimately it failed for that reason. National Bolshevik concept, then, finds itself really coming of age in the post-revolutionary Bonapartist era, which eventually killed him, ironically enough. Number one, building economic ties with the West and vice versa. Number two, ending the ideological utopianism of Trotsky and his group. Number three, that it was a highly militarized dictatorship, protecting the empire from Western influences and capitalism. Number four, eliminated the old landed class, which is pretty stupid. They have been eliminated since the 19th century. And finally, it ended the parliament, the Duma, which we all agree was a complete fraud. So even in fear of the NEP and beyond, he interprets as the revolution becoming Russian, Bolshevism having really nothing to do with socialism. It wasn't a socialist empire at all. It was a militantly atheist Russian empire of revolutionary caste. He is not a nationalist. Make that very clear. He attacks the Slavophiles because the idea of the nation is, while very real, is too vague. Revolutionary movement doesn't change, however, the soul of a people. That center, what makes a nation, doesn't go away no matter what you do. The October Revolution, in his mind, unified Slavic space for the first time, brought peace, finally, ending of war and World War I, of course. Independence of the Russian people created a new path. He thought of it as a third way at the time. He didn't see it as a socialist experiment whatsoever. And that the economy seemed to be aiming at one point, being self-contained. Now, even Trotsky admits that the Soviet Union was built by the West. So again, Ustyalov, although he's a brilliant man, fails completely here. Bolshevism is national by definition in his mind because it was the only Bolshevik empire in the world. Therefore, to defend it is to defend Russia and Ukraine and members of the empire. So Bolshevism had to be national. There had to be a certain patriotism. Whenever you went out to the international arena and defended the policies of the Soviet Union, you were defending the motherland. It was national by definition. Again, this is a radical stretch of the concept of nation. Destroying capitalism, destroying the old landed class, destroying the old bureaucracy, was a way to remake Russian history and a way to revolutionize and to protect the Russian people from Western decadence. Capitalism is a totalitarian system. It controls every aspect of your life. Ultimately, there's only three kinds of state. Number one, the party state, the ideological state, idiocracy, so to speak. The second is a bureaucratic apparatus, the so-called Oriental despotism. And number three, oligarchy, the republics and democracy in Novgorod in Russian history. And ultimately, the Soviet Empire became a combination of one and two. Pure ideology can never work by itself, no matter what Trotsky says. The core of national Bolshevism in Ustryalov's mentality is the struggle to reconcile the right wing to the Bolshevik takeover. That once the revolutionaries are in power, they're not really leftists anymore. They are militarists and dictators, and they function very similarly to a fascist anywhere else. They become very conservative once they're in power. His view was that the Russian soul will eventually take over, and the Bolsheviks will have to make their peace with it, and they'll have no problem of making their peace with it. He fails to do this theoretically. It failed to happen historically, and Stalin, the man that he thought was the Napoleon, ended up ordering his execution in 1937. So he does fail, but we can sympathize with his position, with someone who sees the motherland torn apart and is trying to make sense out of it. He's a brilliant man, brilliant writer. He is certainly worthwhile, but the system ultimately fails. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.